Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to 4.0 to Pro, the pickleball podcast that focuses on a single shot, tip, or strategy to improve your pickleball game with every single pocket-sized episode. Our goal is to make you better on the court every time you hear our voices. And now your hosts, 4.something Michael O'Neill, and USA Pickleball National Silver Medalist, Senior Pro Scott Fliegelman.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of 4.0 to Pro, your pocket-sized pickleball podcast, where we teach you a single shot or strategy every single episode. I'm Michael O'Neill here in Long Beach, California, joined by my good pal, Mr. Scott Fliegelman, right now in Naples, Florida, getting ready for the U.S. Open.
I still think this is probably my favorite tournament. Part of the reason, I guess, is I get to hang out with my friends Nancy and Craig, who are putting me up for the week. It's just poolside dinner. I'm getting my Florida on and pro clinics tomorrow morning with Megan and Ryler. And then off we go for the week. It's going to be awesome.
One of the really cool things, guys, that Scott is doing while he's down there is he's going to be the color commentator for the split age mixed pro on Tuesday. And that's super exciting, dude. I'm not sure if you've ever been in the booth like that before, but that is very cool. And hopefully we'll get a chance to listen.
I've dabbled a bit, but not necessarily had the chance to do it for reals. A little bummed Jill Braverman can't make it down for us to play in the event, but really stoked that Rusty from the Pickleball Channel reached out and asked me to join him in the booth. It'll be the day after I take the court with Ryler DeHart for split age men's pro, and we were bronze medalists last year, and we're looking to move up a step or two. So I think the timing will be good. I'll get in the booth, and I'll have a feel for the uniqueness that is split age, which I think is really unique stuff. And looking forward to sharing my views on the show.
Well, this is a very cool chance. And now you're like a seasoned veteran on the microphone that you probably weren't the first time you did this. Now you're a real pro.
I'm a little spoiled. I've got the right partner in my phones with you, but Rusty's pretty good. He's been around the block a couple times. Really the first guy I ever paid attention to when I started pickleball. I watched all of the Pickleball Channel YouTube matches from the old US Open, and he was the voice in my head as I started learning this game. So it'll be cool to be working with him.
If you guys haven't done it, go back and look at some of the finals from like 10 years ago, like the national championships. And I swear it would be like a 4-0 championship at this point. It's crazy how much the game has evolved since then.
I was a tennis snob coming into the sport, and I watched some of that, and I was like, I think I can do that. And you know, turned out I got out there and got my butt kicked by a lot of those people. But yeah, you're right. The top of the game looks a lot more sophisticated and professional now.
So we're doing something a little different. We kind of got our lines crossed a teeny bit. When I asked for questions for last week's Q&A show, I did it on Instagram with the Instagram, whatever, question prompt. And I was surprised to not have gotten any. It was sort of like, where are all these questions? I thought people were out there.
We thought we were all that, but...
We thought we were all that. And I ended up fielding questions that I had already had in the email box. And then like during the week, I looked at my Instagram and the sort of notifications, and there were all the questions, and there's a whole bunch of them. So we've decided, because Scott, you're there in Naples, you got enough on your mind, that we're going to do a sort of a back-to-back Q&A thing. And I think it's going to be good because there's a lot of juicy questions in here today. And then we'll go back to our regularly scheduled programming, which I think is going to be the right side player breakdown. And then maybe we'll do the left side player breakdown in the following week. But for now, let's jump back into a really good Q&A, Scott. And I will lead us off here with the first question, which is from DDD3Man. By the way, if you guys want to follow us on Instagram, it's 4.0 to pro. There's underscores 4.0 underscore 2 underscore pro. And anyway, DDD3Man says, how do you determine selecting a partner and what side each should play on? I'm assuming this is rec play, but I think this would probably apply to tournament play as well. I think there are people that are more comfortable in certain situations. And I think it really depends on the partner, because I might be a better left side person with obviously a lefty, or someone who's got a really killer two-handed backhand or something like that. Or if I'm playing with a guy who's like 6'5", then I will defer and be the right side player and try to play that role as best as I can. In rec play, very often I'll just ask, what are you more comfortable with? You want to serve first, that kind of thing. But it's a little more loosey-goosey, because that first game, you really have no idea what each other is capable of. I think what I did the other day is I did exactly what I just said, which is just like, oh, you know, I'll serve or you serve. And then at the second game, I said, oh, you know, why don't we switch it this way? We seem to play a little better like this. But we didn't stack or anything. It was just a matter of the pecking order in terms of who was receiving serve and that kind of thing.
A couple of thoughts that are around this topic. I'd like to think that one of my greatest strengths as a pickleball player is my chameleon-like abilities to be able to partner well with a range of different partners. I think that's given me the opportunity to grow and learn and play right side, play left side, be the alpha, be the beta. So I'm going to encourage you guys to be like that and not pigeonhole yourself as a left side player or a right side player. It may really depend upon who you are on the court with. I'm reading this question maybe a little differently than you, Michael. I think he's asking about selecting a partner for competitive play, like a dedicated partner. And along those lines, let me just throw something out there that I didn't have the fortune to select my partners as I was coming up. I was asking people and they weren't giving me the time of day. And I sort of made my name as a singles player at first. And then the better partners started kind of asking me. So I think you've got to be a nice person. It helps to have some online video. I've had a lot of partners ask me, hey, can I see you play? And in 2019, I didn't have a whole lot of that. I've got plenty of it now, but that was hard at first. So if you're not already videoing all your matches, do that. Get them up on YouTube. That'll help with partner. And as I mentioned earlier, I wouldn't worry too much about what side you should play on. We'll maybe talk more about this, but there are traditional stacking reasons, bigger, stronger, more powerful player on the left in a right-handed world. But there's a lot of other reasons to mix it up, head-to-head matchups and other reasons to just not be a dedicated left or right side player.
Maybe it's something you put out in the world as well. Like if you do feel like you are better on one side or the other, if you're in a group or something like that, you could be like, hey, I'm a left side specialist or right side specialist. Scott, you just said something about the bigger, stronger player being on the left-hand side. The Fit Fisherman asks, we stack with the bigger forehand on the left to maximize power. Are there any other stack setups? I thought that was a good thing to dovetail into your answer.
That's why you get the big bucks, host. Right on. And that's kind of where I was going with it. I did a mandatory stacking clinic yesterday at Boulder Pickleball. And I always get the eye rolls and the groans. And then at the end of the clinic, they're like, thank you so much for making us full stack today, because we're not fully fluent in it yet unless we practice it. I shared with that group that, yeah, you got your bigger, stronger, taller, longer player on the left side. And that's the traditional reasons. I've been really focused on head-to-head matchups lately. If I want to be across from a particular opponent on the other side, we might stack for those reasons. That could put me on the right or the left or back and forth, so I can win the hands battle with the player directly in front of me. Obviously, there's lefty righty. If you're a left-handed player at 4-0 to pro and you're not already stacking religiously, you have some catch-up work to do. And Michael, anything else you can think of?
Other than maybe in a particular week, you're feeling a particular thing, like your two-handed drive is really good, so you can use it for an amazing counter in the middle or something like that, but not really. I tend to default to the, you know, bigger, stronger player on the left-hand side kind of vibe. Or yeah, if you're having an off day, we've talked about that on the show before, where it's like, man, I'm not doing what I normally do. I'm going to let the other person kind of take over the game, and I'll be in this sweep up deferential role, the beta role, And I did that at the NPL tryouts. My second day, I was just like, man, I'm not feeling too good for these two games. And just let the other guy, said, why don't you just take over this game right now? And it worked out for us. It worked great, actually.
Yeah, and not only having a bad day, but having a bad 5 minutes. If you're down 7-1 and you call a timeout, coming out and giving them a different look is a really great way to get them off serve and get the ball back. I've shared on the show before that Scott Moore and I played a whole bunch together last summer, and he is a legendary Hall of Fame left side player. And we came out of a timeout down 10-6, I believe, with Scott on the right. We stacked that way all the way to the end of the game. We won the game, and then we took the third game. That's not something that our opponents are accustomed to seeing, and they told us after the match that that impacted their strategy. So there's three or four good reasons to be fully fluent in stacking, especially at the 4-0 plus level.
Once again, DDD3Man says, what are the three most important shots you should focus on with limited practice time?
Can I start off my answer with, it depends?
Sure.
You know, I mean, it'd be great to know a little bit more about DDD3Man. What levels he playing? Men's, mixed, women's, I don't know. It says DDD3Man, maybe. Maybe not a shot, but boy, I think 7-11 is just kind of the primary drilling session go-to workout if you've got limited time, because it puts together the third, a fifth in the transition zone, the fourth, and then we've got dinking, we've got firefights, instigating. It's kind of got it all in one. So maybe not exactly what he's looking for there, but with lack of anything else, 7-11 is a great way to go.
We had some rain here the other day, Scott, as it's been quite rainy the whole season. And I was able to set up in the squash courts. It was windy and rainy and gross outside. And we have these Yola screens to prevent the balls from going on one court to the other. And they're about 30 inches high, I think. But you take that with a couple of the things have in the TRX room, these little plastic squares with a rubber mat on top, and put these things on top, it's exactly 34 inches. So we found a way in a very backyard pickleball-y way to set this little 8-foot, 10-foot net up in the squash court. And I broke out my tape measure. I had some blue masking tape, and we made ourselves, like you guys have there at Boulder Pickleball, we made ourselves a little dink court. 2.5 hours, we drilled instigator, hands, and even cross court instigation. And when I tell you that much focus on instigating, hands, and counters was invaluable, because that following week, I felt so crisp with all of those things. I knew right where my X was. We talk about lowering the X and how low you can speed up from. I did that drill that we saw on Ben John's page, where he's speeding up with a two-handed backhand to Colin's right shoulder, who comes back across to Ben's forehand. We drilled that. We did a ton. And I just remember thinking, if the only drill I ever did was just this instigator drill, I could totally be happy in pickleball. That absolutely is part of the 7-Eleven drill, which does have a broader, grander appeal. But we didn't have enough space to do that. So we just did the instigator, and it was fantastic. So that, for me, is probably 7-Eleven would be number one, and the instigator would be number two.
I'm with you there. I wish I knew these things when I was starting. I had some racquetball court time with foul weather and didn't know what the heck I was doing. But now I do. So right. I happen to have an indoor facility, so I guess I don't need that quite as much these days.
Ursino Pro. I'm not sure if I pronounced that right. We're gonna double this up. He says, do you think more powerful paddles will hurt or help the game overall as the trend continues? And then Cole Scott Photo says, is the game getting too fast? So Scott, I played with a prototype paddle the other day, and I played with the Gearbox Power before, which previously had been the most powerful paddle I'd ever picked up. It was hilarious how powerful it was. I picked up this other paddle from another company, and I couldn't believe the velocity coming off. It changed the game. I didn't play with it because I tried for a few points and I was sending balls like over the fence. But once I got the hang of it a little bit and hit a few serves, I hit a few serves off this guy who was like 23 years old, 5-0 player who could not get a handle on him. That's how hard the serves were. And it was crazy. I do think they are making a massive difference. And I remember when we very first started playing together, and even on this show, we talked about paddles, one of the first episodes. That's what I wanted to talk to you guys about. If you're brand new to the podcast, these are somewhat linear. So if you haven't already, go back to episode one and work your way through the catalog. Binge your way through the forehands and backhand drives and the dinks and drops and the thirds and the fourths and the fifths, all the stuff we've already talked about on the show. Go back and listen to that stuff if you haven't already. It is somewhat critical because we are assuming that many of you have been with us for a little while now, and we have this bed of knowledge that we are working from. But if you haven't gone back and listened to the old shows, they're all evergreen. You're going to learn a ton from every single episode. Back to my point. You mentioned at the very beginning of the show, Scott, get the most powerful paddle you can and then figure out how to tame it. For me, when I started playing with the Carbon 1X, get 10% off your favorite carbon paddle using the promo code 402P at checkout. I had a really hard time with my resets for weeks. Probably 6 weeks it took me before I would really pop a reset up and really got my body acclimated to this powerful paddle. And now it's hand to glove for me. So I'm curious if now playing some of these more powerful paddles, does that mentality still apply, A? And B, what is your opinion as a pro player who's now starting to face these hammers of paddles that are coming out?
You're right. You did remember correctly that I suggested broadly to get a hold of the most powerful paddle possible and learn how to tame it, because the way the game was changing, especially at the 4-5 plus level, that a lot of rally victories come down to hands battles, and you're going to want that ball to come off that paddle. I had played a tournament with a soft gearbox, and I hit lovely drops and lovely dinks and had all kinds of control, but I was losing hands battles. And so that dictated the advice that I shared with you and shared with listeners. You guys may also recall that I now play with the softest, most control-oriented carbon, the 116. And I've begun theorizing that my reason for the switch was I'm primarily an indoor player and was playing last year's NPL season with an Oso ball, which was relatively hot. And I'd kind of committed to, I think a control paddle is a better way to go, being an indoor specialist like I am. I still don't play much outdoors. I'm about to in the heat and humidity in Naples. And I've got a couple of rolls of lead tape with me, and I'm going to see what I can do, but I'm not planning on switching to the more powerful paddle. All that being said, I'm bullish on all new paddle technology that passes the tests from USA Pickleball, because I still think it comes down to the practitioner in whose hands the paddle is being held. I can think back a month or so playing against Morgan Shepherd in one of my best singles matches ever, and he was playing with a Gearbox Pro Power with just an amazing amount of skill to be able to keep the ball in play, imparting spin and just a lot of technique and touch and control. And you put these paddles in the hands of an unskilled player, and the court is still 22 feet long on the other side of the net. It's still primarily a wiffle ball we're playing with. So jury's out. There's a lot more powerful paddles on the market now, and I've not converted to one yet. But maybe we'll circle back on this in a month or two, and I'll give you my updated thoughts.
One thing I will say is that you're margin for error becomes much slimmer with a really powerful paddle, meaning you better have your swing path right. Because the people I see at my local club here in California, if they get this brand new gearbox and they don't have a nice dialed in, compact, top spinny type stroke, then they're sailing the ball over the fence. And when they do have their stuff together and they're really focusing on their swing path and getting that 5-11 topspin on the ball and really stroking it and getting it to tuck in, wow, that thing can be an unbelievable shot. But I think it does require a lot more diligence in getting your shot right, getting the actual swing path right.
Yeah, I mean, if you speed up a fifth from the transition zone from 8 inches off the ground, I don't care how powerful your paddle is, you don't have enough margin of error to play with over the net above 30 miles an hour or whatever it is. You can't produce enough spin to get the ball to drop in 22 feet and hit it that fast. So, I mean, you still have to be able to play the game, leveraging the poor bounce of the ball and the non-volley zone. And surely if you get a counterattack in the sweet spot, then that would be a great time to have a powerful paddle in your hand, but you've got to get that far in the rally first.
I agree 100%, and don't call me Shirley. French Toast says, thoughts on ways, I'm going to take this one, thoughts on ways to control anger other than paddle breaking. Well, let me tell you something.
Paddle chucking?
What's that?
Can you chuck a paddle? Does that count as something else? Or?
We used to, on the racquetball court, we used to joke that there should be a little glass door with a really crappy racquetball racket in there that when you got mad, you could just open the door and whack. It was like in case of emergency, break glass and just, you know, pound this. I have definitely had a racket or two mysteriously break in half. Here's what I'll say, at least in the pickleball world. I'm pretty good about my emotions. My emotions are never directed at anyone else. I had a rec game a couple days ago where they hit a hilarious amount of net cords. Like, it was absurd. It was 14 or something in a game. It was like, what, really? What are we doing? So it got funny at some point, because of course it's going to be a point on a net court. But I did go through a little anger phase in that whole thing, and it was just like, oh man. One thing that's helped me out, French Toast, is that when I see someone who's like a 3-5 or a 4-0 player, and they make a mistake, and I see them get really mad, and I am watching from the sidelines, I can see exactly what happened. I can see that the previous shot they hit was too high, or they made a mistake going XYZ, and they're just mad. But I'm looking at it going, yeah, but that was 100% your fault. The thing that just happened was your fault. And I think if some pro was watching me play and saw what I just did, saw the shot I just missed, they would very easily be able to say, well, yeah, your footwork was off, or you were too slow to the ball, or you didn't come around it, your swing path was wrong. They would be able to see the same thing. And what I infer from that on court at the moment is I say, guess what, dude, O'Neal, this is exactly as good as you are right now. Because if you were better, you wouldn't have hit that mistake that you just made. Everyone's going to make a mistake, and sometimes things are fluky. But if you went back and watched the film of the thing that just happened that made you mad, could you identify, oops, I didn't do something right? And that just means that's as good as you are at pickleball right now. And that, for me, is very helpful on the court. I can think of an incident, Scott, that one of the very few times I've seen you mad on court, but it was because a ball on match point did not come up on a serve because it hit a dead spot in the court. And I thought that was very well worth arguing.
Are you going to bring that up? I was just about to talk about how calm and peaceful I am and zen. And I rarely ever get angry, but that one was an outlier. I love the way you answered the question. I was just going to accentuate it by saying something we've said to you guys hundreds of times on this show. Video everything. Michael talked a lot about, go back and watch the tape. Go back and watch the, you know, well, you gotta have it recorded. And unless Dave Fleming is commentating all your matches, then you may need your own recording device, which I think could help. That was really good advice, Michael.
Thank you. Isaiah D099 and the corresponding one, David Kittner. David says, a lot of times it's just me and the wall. What are your best wall drills? Thanks for a great show. And then DD099 says, does a pickleball wall help your reactions in volley game? So I'm a big advocate of wall. I have done...
this one's all you, man.
I've done a lot of wall work, guys. I may end up doing some more this weekend if it gets rainy and nobody else wants to play. I think there's a lot of stuff you can do, including what you just said, which is help reactions in volley games. The thing about the wall, it's pretty relentless. You whack a ball really hard at the wall, it's coming back at almost that same speed. So you do have to react to it quite a bit. A couple drills that I think are really super useful for me were the volleyball dig drill, where you're just in that squat down, hand, you know, pronated, paddle is down between your legs, just like you would be in the transition zone if somebody were going to hit a really hard ball and you had to defend. So think of yourself in the volleyball dig position, but with your paddle, and just hit to yourself against the wall. And as you get more comfortable, you can hit a nice drive and then quickly get down into that dig position to dig the ball out. You can practice a ton of that. If you are working on a two-handed backhand, put that paddle in your left hand Focus on your 7 to 1, your 7 p.m. to 1 a.m. spin on the ball. Just hit with your left hand. And if you do it well, that ball will hit the wall sort of towards your right shoulder. And because you've spun it right, it will bounce right back to your left hip where you can rinse and repeat. You do that for 45 minutes. Add that second hand to the paddle. You have a TUI. I don't care what anybody says. You will have enough baseline competency with it to be able to do two-handed dinks. And then as you back up and you can start moving the strike zone, you know, a little bit lower, a little bit harder, paddle a little more horizontal, you'll have a two-handed backhand. And that is something that can absolutely be done in a 45-minute session on a wall. You can always work on your ground strokes, making sure you get, again, the right swing path and stroke on the ball. And then something I really like to do from a hand speed standpoint, I do have some pretty good hands, is I'll volley to myself forehand, backhand, just back and forth, and just get really used to it. As you get more comfortable, you get closer to the wall and you hit harder. So if you can start doing that enough that you can hit a hard forehand and then be able to reset back with your backhand, it's a great drill. You may not be able to sustain that, so it's back and forth. Just being able to hit it and then quickly hit that quick reset to bounce in, man, you can occupy yourselves for hours and hours and hours. Put your favorite audiobook on or your favorite music and get to the wall.
Well, you guys heard it directly from the wall master there. So take his advice and get after it.
S. Grady G. says, when playing doubles, do you and Scott and your partners call each shot? What talk tactics do you use? So I'm going to let you answer this, Scott, since you and I have only been on the court one single time together on the same team.
And when we were on the same side of the court, I think we were doing a pretty good job calling the ball. And surprisingly, I'm going to share with you guys that I think this is one of the biggest differences between the 4-0 and a 5-0 player. The 5-0 player, the 5-0 team, is doing a much better job eliminating confusion and calling the ball. Whereas I see the 4-0 team way too frequently on middle balls. Nothing is called and confusion is had and paddles are clanked. And this is a huge opportunity for improvement. It's not a very large court and there's two athletic players on there. And when you watch pro pickleball, you're going to see a lot of gratuitous calling of the ball. A lot of times it's blatantly obvious whose ball it is, but they're in the habit of verbally claiming the ball or offering it to their partner. One of my favorite things to do after we've served and the ball comes back, I will often calmly say, hey, you take this one, partner, or some calm words to let my playing partner know I'm not in your way and I have confidence in you. And partners have told me that that's what they get from the way that I say that. Or a loud and prompt, mine, or I go, or me, something that makes it clear. The last part of your question, S. Grady G., what talk tactics do you use? I think I know what you're saying here, and I'm going to offer two. There's the captain approach, where the more verbal, aggressive, talkative player tends to do most of the talking, claiming me, mine, you go, and they're sort of the talker for the team. And another tactic, it really just depends on who you're playing with, is claiming the ball in first person as early as possible. And there's a great drill to do this. The four of you can get up to the non-volley zone line and bat the ball around. And let's get in the habit of claiming every single ball before it crosses the net so that we get in the habit. And that lets your partner know to get their paddle out of there. And it's my ball.
It's interesting too, because I think a lot of times you don't hear it if you're watching a game on YouTube. But if you really listen closely, they are chattering quite a bit. There's a lot of talk happening between partners as they go through. I tend to be, especially in rec play, I tend to be the very verbal one, especially at the beginning of the game. If I find myself right side, let's say it's the very beginning of the game, I'm the first receiver and we win that first point. So now I'm the first server from our team. I will turn to my partner who's playing left side and I'll say, I never want to hit a backhand third. So take those balls in the middle. If it comes right at me, I'm going to take the forehand. I'm going to make it a practice to not hit a backhand third if I can avoid it. So I'll say that before we even start. And then as the ball comes in, I just had it happen the other day. The guy wasn't comfortable with getting those balls in the middle, those responses. He would serve, they would return. And I'd say, you, and he'd be all the way over towards the left side sideline and leave the middle wide open. So I would end up having to take sort of a late backhand, and we were usually behind at that point. I'm struggling to keep the ball down when it could have been a short return and we could have really gotten back into it. So I tend to be the vocal one if nobody else is on the court. So I think you can almost train each other and at the very beginning of the game say, hey, look, if it's a tournament type situation, you're going to be used to each other and you're going to understand that. But if you're playing rec type play, let people know that you are hoping that they will say something and that you will be saying something to them as well. Because I think it's just going to make things a lot easier for you.
Yeah, absent of an obviously talkative partner on the court, left side players, I'm looking in your direction. You should be getting more balls in a right-handed world, but you're going to need to claim them. Verbally, get your partner's backhand volley out of there by calling me or mine before the ball comes across the net.
Lastly, but not leastly, when poaching the fifth shot, where should I target? Should I follow my momentum or go middle or across? I think you should aim low. If you can see their feet, hit their feet. But I think there's a bit of nuance on this, depending if it's a third shot drive or drop. But either way, if the ball is up, what do you think, Scott?
Well, what's up, Greg Marinelli? Thanks for asking the question. I view this question as maybe in the shake and bake realm. I'm seeing myself on the left. I'm seeing my partner. Let's say it's you, Greg, hitting a third shot drive or drop, and the opponents try to hit their fourth shot back to you. They try to keep you back, and I'm having none of it, and I'm going to poach that ball by moving from the left side to the right side where my big forehand is getting ready. I see this as a pretty athletic move, and I'm going to go with one of your suggestions, which is follow my momentum, and I'm going to borrow Michael's answer too. I want to get this ball down at the player right in front of me or in the space around them for a couple of reasons. It's the closest target. It's right in front of me, and if there's any chance whatsoever of that ball coming back, I give myself a fighting chance of dealing with that next ball. This is where I'm bummed that I'm 56 and not Federico Staxrud, and I can't slide on the court so that I can stop my momentum and get back in play a little bit faster. These guys do this so well, and I'm running into the fence. Like, I just can't stop and go back where I came from like I used to. But, you know, Greg, if you're my partner, you may need to play singles for the next shot because I'm out of the picture. And that's what happens often when you poach this ball. So hopefully I've answered your question. I think it's very well phrased. Thanks.
Yeah, there's a big commitment there. And then that's it. There's no way you can get your way back in. So that makes sense. That's going to do it for today's show, folks. Thank you so much, as always, for your questions. Until next week, we'll talk to you very soon. Go enjoy yourselves on the pickleball court. Keep on rocking.
Thank you for listening to 4.0 to Pro. For more tips, find us on Instagram at 4.0 to Pro. If you have a pickleball question, submit it at picklehelp.com. Now, get out there and dominate. But don't forget to have fun.